moral wit, every important American conductor has been Jewish, even.
Uh-huh.
Bernstein, Wallenstein, you name them.
Uh-huh.
Lauren Mazel. There's just so much talent.
I've always been sort of pro-Jewish because I found that I get along better with Jews. I mean, they tend to be more ambitious, and they have a reputation of being a little bit pushy, and I think I'm a little bit pushy. I hope I'm not, obnoxiously pushy, but you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and they do tend to be smarter. So I myself am, to some extent pro-Jewish, but I think that, I don't want to go into a long thing about this, but one of the things that Nathaniel and Sylvia and I came up with was we decided that you might have something like a bimodal distribution, and that's a distribution of assertiveness. And so it may be that the average Jew is optimally assertive, but then you've got this group, which is maybe not quite as big as the other, hump at the top, which is really, really obnoxiously pushy.
Yeah.
And, the thing is, I was their house guest for a year in Florida, and there are a lot of Jews in Florida. And the stories that they would tell about what people had done and what people had said, these Jews who came down from New York and stuff, I just don't see how you could hardly avoid the conclusion that they were,
That may be. I've run into that having lived in New York myself. I'm not sure it's a purely Jewish thing. I think it may be traits that were brought over from parts of Europe where this is sort of modal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't find that much in the among the Jews in the academic community. I think you may find it more in Sephardic Jews than the Ashkenazic Jews. I'm not sure, but I haven't felt this about Jews that I've known in the academic world.
Mm-hmm.
With people I know who dealt with Jews in the business world have felt this.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember I went to an optometrist and I got some glasses. And so the glasses cost pretty much money. And so I said, do I get a glasses case with this? Because I hated this guy. I hated him, really, because he's so obnoxious and everything. And so he says, that'll be $2. And I thought, It just made you sick, because, you ought to give somebody a glasses case. It's a little cheap plastic piece of junk, and they just bought some glasses, and then he's trying to get two more dollars out of me, right? And, so I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, I don't think we can go much beyond the anecdotal level on that topic, so.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, on question number 14, I think maybe we should just cross off question number 14, unless you think you have something you particularly want to say, but on second thought, I just thought, maybe this is not a very good question.
Yeah, there's not much that could be said that anyone couldn't answer for himself, in a way. It's just a matter of getting information out to the people who are concerned.
Right, right. I mean, it's like, why am I asking you this question? It doesn't seem very good.
Yeah, okay. Now, let's see, number 16. Why does the media continue to distort this issue, and what can be done about it? Well, the only reason I can give for the media continuing to distort this is that, a couple of things. One is simply ignorance on their part.
Uh-huh.
I run into media people who actually believe, the contrary to these views that are expressed in that question. And we're very surprised and rather to hear that there were people of a scientific background who espoused these views.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have anything against them themselves. They just thought that that's the way things are, that science says that there are no genetic differences, and it's just the far-out kooks who believe otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And when they learned that that's not the case, they themselves felt rather relieved.
Mm-hmm.
And in one case, the guy was even rather, thought it was a kind of a newsworthy thing, and was glad to report it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it. not sure, but it seems to be the case. And I've had the liberal people, when I've asked them this very question, they said, well, you know, most of the media are just very much on the liberal side. If you ask newspaper reporters and editors and this, that, and other thing, what party they're in, most of them are Democrats, most of them are liberal Democratic Party, and so on.
Well, I remember reading about a study that tested undergraduates in different fields, like in business, and engineering, and different hard sciences, and journalism and literature, you know, things like that, about their political beliefs. And the business, I mean, it's exactly like you would imagine. The business people, the hard science people, tended to be conservative. The literature and journalism people tended to be very liberal. So, I mean, it may be that the people who go into journalism are liberal to begin with.
Yeah, I think so, right. And so that's another reason. And then the third reason, I think, is that I think they think they're appealing to their readership by taking this liberal stance
mm-hmm.
on these particular issues.
Mm-hmm.
They're upholding the common man's desire to be equal to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that they think it's just good news policy to take the environmentalist side of all these issues.
Mm-hmm.
So well, those are the only three things I can think of.
I noticed in Ann Landers a while back, some woman who had written in, and one of her adopted children turned out to be a Jew and delinquent. And so Ann Landers' comment was that an awful lot more is genetic than people realize. And, you know, I thought that was sort of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. And Ann Landers is Jewish, incidentally.
Yeah. well, you know, on this question 17, I haven't quite, I think this is another not very good question because I don't know, to tell you the truth, what is policy in public education and where does it come from? I mean, we can either eliminate this question or we can try to, you know, make some sense out of it if you want to. It doesn't, whichever way you want to do.
Yeah, well, policy in public education is not any monolithic policy that, permeates the whole educational system. It's whatever a particular school board and so forth decides on.
But I mean, for example, wouldn't busing and tracking
right.
or
yeah,
no tracking
yeah,
or
there's policy at the national level, there's policy at state levels and at local levels. And a general policy that would say support school busing, a national policy that would support it. We actually don't have a national policy to support. I mean, the present administration doesn't support busing.
Mm-hmm.
Originates either with politicians or in the bureaucracy. Now, a lot of educational policy continues on in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, in the bureaucracy at that level, independently of whoever's in the White House and whatever party is in power at the time. Goes on. There's a large group of bureaucrats who sort of remain a kind of a constant in the picture over every administration.
Well, as far as the influence of your research, I heard maybe from you or I don't know where I heard this, but that when your 1969 Harvard Educational Review article came out, that whoever was in the White House, I can't remember. Nixon, yeah. That this was going, you know, people in the White House were reading this, and I just was wondering whether that and also your work on bias and mental testing, I mean, this might have had a lot of influence as far as, you know, sort of putting a lid or holding back some of these trends about...
Well, it may have had, it's hard to say. It certainly hasn't, to my knowledge, on any official level. But, you know, some
yeah,
of the
but
things
they
I
won't
advocated,
acknowledge
like teaching in a rote fashion and so forth, actually became more widespread after that article.
Mm-hmm.
And whether my article had anything to do with that directly, there's no way of knowing. It may be the teachers were just shaped by the pupils to do whatever seemed to work, and since that seemed to work better than other things, they were led in that direction. And programs like Sesame Street are based entirely on sort of rote teaching of concepts and letters and numbers and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if they just, as if I'd written a prescription for them and they were carrying it out to the letter.
Mm-hmm.
But whether that stems from anything I had done, I don't really know. I know a lot of attention was paid to the things that I had written and said and so forth, but how much impact it's had, I'm not at all sure. Despite all the research on test bias and so forth, court decisions are still being made that go completely against all of that research evidence.
Well, I'm anxious to find out more about what the recent court decisions have been and whether, and to your knowledge, like say even before bias ML testing was published, is it just like a situation where you've got one case after another that says the tests are biased, we can't use them?
Oh, right,
I mean, in other words, are there no instances in which the judge says, no, we have to use the test?
Oh, right, yeah, there are. But interestingly enough, there's the famous case in Chicago with Judge Grady. The case was just paralleled perfectly, the Larry P. case, and in fact, there was great overlap in the witnesses they had. They had many of the same expert witnesses in Chicago, and the issues were exactly the same
mm-hmm.
as they were in California. The only thing that was really different was the judge.
Mm-hmm. And what year is this?
Oh, this is about close to 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge said that, no, he didn't think the tests were biased. That was a decision he came to after hearing all the testimony and examining the tests himself.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a very long decision, and it was more sensible than the judge in California, but I still didn't like it from a psychometric standpoint because he really discounted all the psychometric evidence, all the actual statistical evidence and the research, and he threw out all the testimony of the test experts because they disagreed. I mean, one of the experts was Kamen, who isn't a test expert, and since he disagreed with Thorndike, and who is a test expert, this guy says, I'm having to throw out all the expert testimony, and I'll just look at the test myself. And in looking over the Stanford-Binet and the Wexler tests, item by item, he came to the conclusion that only a few of these items looked biased to him. So on the whole, the test isn't biased. Well, now that's not how you decide whether a test is biased.
Right.
But at least he came to an opposite decision, which meant the Chicago schools could go ahead and use the test.
Uh-huh.
But what did they do? They went ahead and said, no, we think the tests are biased anyway, and they threw out the test. And they're in the same position that we are in California.
So in other words, the judge ruled that tests can be used.
Yeah.
And then the school board said, we choose not to.
The superintendent, who was a black, mm-hmm. Dr. Ruth Love, who had been the superintendent of the Olson School, said, well, we don't agree with the judge's decision. We think they're biased, and so we're not going to use them anyway.
Right.
And so it's just with a school law, not a state law or a city law. And it's things like that, you see. And there's still people in our department at Berkeley who teach that tests are biased. I mean, this is part of the content of their course.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's amazing. I was just thinking because I was listening to the interview from Wednesday and typing it up and all, and I was just remembering when I was in an anthropology course. I was an undergraduate there, and there was really nothing in the course that had much to do with black-white differences in IQ or the validity of IQ tests. It really didn't have anything to do with that. But the professor brought in this woman to give us a lecture for an hour about how Jensen is completely wrong, and the tests are totally biased against blacks, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And I was so angry, you know, this is when I was looking into this, and I had talked to you and gotten a bunch of papers and stuff.
Right.
But I was so angry, and I argued with this woman. You know, I raised my hand. It was huge, huge class, you know, like an auditorium or something. And I argued with this woman, and I was so nervous and so angry that I honestly couldn't see, you know. I mean, I was just so upset that I think I was just practically blind with rage. But, and, you know, I just was not going to let that pass without having my say. And naturally, I mean, I think there were some grateful people there. The people who thought, I'm grateful that someone has said something that is true and reasonable. But of course, the majority of them thought, oh, well, here's some reactionary jerk. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, there's a professor who teaches Psych 1A at Berkeley who does the same thing. I mean, he gives one whole lecture that denounces me and the whole notion of heritability of intelligence and claims the tests are biased and this, that, and the other thing. Just came in line. And required reading for the course is this book by Gould, Kamen, and Lewontin, you know, Not in Our Genes.
Yeah.
That's the only reading that he requires for the unit on intelligence.
Is this guy a Jew or not?
I don't really know.
Oh.
His name is Seth Roberts.
Seth?
Seth
That's Jewish.
Roberts. That's a Jewish name, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Because that comes from the Bible.
I phoned him. I've never met him. I've never seen the guy. He's a young assistant professor. And he's been in Berkeley about 3 years now, but I've never run into him. And someone got me his lecture notes. And there's all of this nonsense in them. And so I called him and told him that I thought that students were being shortchanged in this area and that he was misrepresenting the field and so on. And I found that all his reading is just a Kamen stuff. I mean, he hasn't read anything else. He doesn't know the names of the big people in behavioral genetics, for example.
Well, how did he respond to you? I mean...
Well, he said, when I told him that I'd seen his notes, he has his notes mimeographed and gives them to the students.
Right.
His whole lecture is mimeographed, and he gives them out to the students. He said, oh, well, what did I leave out? And he talked as if he thought he was giving an objective account of the true state of affairs, that this was the common belief. And I told him what to read and so on. And I told him that I almost felt like demanding equal time. And so he said, well, he would be glad to have me in his class as a guest lecturer the next time he gives the course next year if I'm willing. So I said, well, sure, just let me know at least a week in advance and I'll give your students a lecture. So at least he's willing to do that. He felt a bit sheepish, actually. I mean,
did this happen just recently?
Oh, yeah, just a couple of months ago.
So that means that this next year he'll give the class?
Yeah.
I see.
And,
that should be interesting.
Yeah, he gives only one lecture on intelligence. And this is what he gives. It's such a waste. He spends quite a lot of time talking about Cyril Berg, the fraud of Berg, and accusing other people of dishonesty and so on. And he just brings in all the, you might say, the dissident things. And mostly, I could see where he got practically all of it was from Kamen.
Uh-huh.
So when I called him, I asked him, what has he read in this area? And I found that he's read really nothing of any importance. He didn't know the names of, for example, he didn't know Bouchard. He didn't know Sandra Scar. He doesn't know any of the prominent people in behavior genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Plowman or... he didn't know the Minnesota twin study. Imagine. And yet he was talking about the heritability of intelligence.
Well, I think I always get real upset when I feel like a whole bunch of people are being grossly misled.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's good that you'll be able to talk to
them. Yeah, well, he has 1,000 students in that course.
Yeah.
Each year. So, but see, that's going on at a major university like Berkeley. What's happening in other places. So, just so much ignorance and willingness to believe the other side. It's still puzzling to me to understand it. And yet, this survey here, see, everyone isn't as smart as these people in this public interest survey. You know, these various experts here that were
Well, I just wonder if, you know, I watched this guy on TV who wrote this book about AIDS, and he's a journalist from KQED, I think. I can't remember his name. Anyway, he was saying how the response of the public and of the government was just so unbelievably slow and inadequate. And I just wondered if almost anybody who discovers that something is not right about the, you know, about what the public believes and about public policy and these kinds of things and what people should be doing about these different problems. I just wonder if whenever someone discovers something like this, you know, that there might be a whole host of just really grossly and, you know, inefficient and stupid things that are going on in the world. And then if you went into other fields, I mean, I think our field must have more than most, certainly. But if you went into some other fields, I just wonder if you wouldn't find all kinds of unbelievable, stupid, you know, things that were going on. And you might wonder, you know, how can all these people go along believing these things, and why doesn't society sit up and take notice and, for God's sake, do something? And
well, I think that's true, although I do think that the social sciences are the worst in this respect.
Yeah, yeah.
Partly because there's so many vested interests in the issues that are dealt with by social sciences that touch people directly and personally and so on. Whereas, you know, arguments about the nature of black holes and white dwarfs and the size of the known universe and things like that don't touch people very closely.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it seems that the people who oppose IQ tests and the whole idea of genetic basis of individual and group differences, they always manage to come out like they have the moral high ground, that, you know, that we are depraved, and it's because, you know, maybe we are all from upper class backgrounds, and so therefore we're just trying to hold on to our class privileges.
That's right, yeah,
and
that's an
baloney.
Extremely popular belief, yeah. Yeah, it's a disgusting kind of belief, too. But,
yeah, disgusting. And of course, we think we have the moral high ground, and that's because, in my opinion, we do, because because if you're a scientist, then it's you know, self-evident. I mean, you try to figure out what's true. And
and
a lot of these people, I thought it was so fascinating when Shockley, a while back, was saying, he would say to people, some of the things he said and done really, I think, are funny. I mean, I admire him, but he just, you know, he seemed so, I don't know, like not very diplomatic a lot of times.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. but he's got what, don't ever quote me on this, but he's got what my wife refers to as negative charisma.
That's funny. But, I mean, he seems even kind of belligerent.
Yeah, he is.
And the thing is, like, but he said a while back, this is many years ago, when people would disagree with him, he'd say, okay, well, we'll talk about this, and we'll hook you up to a lie detector test. You know, but the thing about it is, see, I mean, I would never say such a thing, and I might not even think of such a thing, but I certainly wouldn't say it. But I mean, there's some real truth to that. I do think that a lot of these people are just lying because they think that, you know, that even if this is not true, that their beliefs are completely erroneous, that it's going to cause social harm for these facts to be known. You see what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Incidentally, speaking of Shockley, I got a call Thursday, I guess it was, from the Morton Downey Show in New York.
Oh, yeah.
You know that crazy show?
Yeah.
And they asked if I would be on it. They said they were going to get Shockley on it, too.
Oh, great. Listen, be sure to let me know when that's going to be.
Well, I said I wouldn't be on it.
Oh.
I had seen it once. Uh-huh. And I had read about it, and there was something on the Koppel's show last night, Ted Koppel's program about it. He had Morton Downey on as a guest.
Uh-huh.
And it's such a rowdy affair. It's the nearest thing to the wrestling matches on TV. Just crazy. I didn't think it was the proper forum for discussion of a really serious topic. It just discussions never get any. what he might be seeing. So I stayed up to see it. And, you know, one of the guests who was invited on was actually dragged off the stage by a couple of Downey security men. This guy had a script in his hand, a shock he could very well have. He says, "No one uses a script on my program. As a matter, can't you talk without reading?" And he grabbed this out of the guy's hand and walked across the stage, and the fellow was very suddenly angered, and he ran across the stage to grab it back from Downey.
Uh-huh.
And one of Downey's security guys ran out there and grabbed this guy around the waist and began tussling with him, and another guy came, and it was kind of a little wrestling match for a few seconds. And they just dragged this guy off. Downey says, "Get that slime ball off of this stage."
Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean,
he calls his guests the pablum pukers, and,
Yeah, I know. I can't stand to watch it. I mean, sometimes I just watch it for a few minutes.
Yeah.
But then I can't take it for very long.
And they never did pursue a line of reasoning or argumentation.
Yeah, yeah.
On that program.
Yeah, it's interesting because, they don't let anybody say more than two or three sentences.
Oh, right. And he gets off onto irrelevancy. For example, one guy says, Downey says, "What's the matter? Are you afraid to express your opinions? Are you afraid to speak out, you mealy-mouthed academic?" And this guy said, "Well, no," he says, "I'm willing to answer any question. Ask me any question, I'll answer it." And he says, "Okay, I'll take you up on that. How many times have you been unfaithful to your wife?" And the guy says, "Never." And Downey says, "Okay, how many times have you had sex with your wife? I'll bet you've never had sex with her." And the guy says, "Well, I wouldn't know that." And Downey says, "Well, of course." He says, "What intelligent woman would lie there and let a fat slob like you get on top of her?"
Oh, that's a disgrace.
Isn't that terrible?
That's an unbelievable disgrace.
It's just unbelievable. Now, who's going to go there as a guest and put up with that kind of thing?
I don't think anyone should. I mean, the thing is, I was thinking Shockley is more, he's more belligerent, and he kind of likes to argue, I think.
That's right, yeah.
But the thing is that, I mean, this guy calls
anywhere.
The shots. I mean, it's his program, and he calls the shots,
all
and he's
right.
He's not a smart guy. He has no manners whatsoever. He's vulgar,
yeah.
and rude, and so I think it would be a big mistake for him to be on, too.
I think so. Downey just walks away from guests. When he doesn't like what they're saying, he walks away with a mic. And they can just cut him off, and then he calls on somebody from the audience or something else.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like...
control.
Yeah, it's really awful, I think. Well, the thing is, too, that, I mean, the kind of arguments that are involved in all the things that we're concerned with, they are arguments which cannot be stated, like, in one sentence or... you know, two words.
Oh, absolutely.
And so if you don't get a chance to at least get in a paragraph every once in a while, I've noticed that the smarter the people are, you know, like real dumb people, they just kind of grunt and and groan and, you know. And then if you get a little smarter, you get to one-liners.
Yeah.
And then you get a little smarter still. Real smart people tend to talk in paragraphs. They don't just say one sentence. They might have three things that lead up to a conclusion or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And if you're not given the opportunity to say more than two sentences, you'll never get any point across.
That's right. Absolutely.
And it's interesting because I saw a panel discussion with, what's her name, Jean Kirkpatrick.
Yeah.
And she has a panel discussion where each person says everything he or she has to say and then stops. And then the next person says something. And I think that is so much nicer and more civilized and more beneficial to the people who are listening,
right, yeah,
than these other political programs, which, of course, aren't nearly as bad as this Downey guy, but...
Yeah, but things like Crossfire and...
Yeah, they interrupt people all over the place,
right.
And you just cannot get to anything. You can't reach any kind of conclusions. You can't have an intelligent discussion when
That's
you have
right.
that atmosphere.
Barkley's program is good in that respect.
Yeah.
He lets people talk, and then he follows up on it, and, I mean, there's some thought going on there.
Right, right.
Some analysis and argument, real argument, not just shouting back and forth. There was one point where Downey was shouting back and forth with one of his guests, and it was all bleeps because of his delay. Bleep, bleep, back and forth, back and forth.
Well, you know, if Shockley does decide to go on that program and see, I mean, the fact that this is just a guess, but the fact that, you know, it doesn't look like a good idea may not deter him. But if he does go on it, I'd like to know when so I could watch it.
Yeah, right. I'm going to call him again to see if he's really going to do it. And if he is, I want to know because it's fun to see.
Yeah.
Might be pathetic, but... Well, this business about education and politics, I think politics has an awful lot to do with educational policy. I've seen examples of that right here in California. For example, there was a rather conservative group in the Bakersfield schools who wanted me to come in and do an evaluation of school segregation problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, and I wrote an article called Schools Cheat Minority Children. So I did they paid for a big project. I mean, they gave me a grant of something like $70,000 to go in with assistants and test something close to 5,000 kids and do a lot of statistical analysis and so forth to determine whether kids in segregated schools were doing worse than kids in integrated schools and that sort of thing. Because such a huge part of the budget in Kern County is taken up by busing because the schools and school districts are so far apart that the bus is extremely costly there. He had a school board meeting plus in writing, and that school board actually hired a team from California Test Bureau to go over my report and to make a report on it at the same meeting. And they gave it a complete bill of health. They said I did everything right statistically and it was sort of an optimal analysis. They would support the conclusions and so forth. Well, at the next election, a new school board came into power. And at one of their first meetings, they denounced my report as incompetent and racist, and voted to have the conclusions of it and everything stricken from the minutes of the acceptance of the report from the minutes of the previous board meeting and so forth. This all was written up in the Bakersfield newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an example, and I've seen the same kinds of things happen in the Berkeley schools where their political groups actually dictate the policies adopted by the school board. They're pressure groups like lobbyists and various kinds of pressure groups that harangue at school board meetings and so on. And a lot of these school policy decisions are made on the basis of these political pressures.
Well, let me ask you about this Bakersfield thing.
Yeah.
Was your conclusion that a greater degree of segregation was not going to be harmful?
That's right. Yeah, that
So they didn't like that conclusion.
Segregated schools that black and Chicano. We had three groups that compared: white, Chicano, or Mexican Americans, we called them, and black. And that if you look at the nonverbal IQ scores, Raven's matrices and Lord Thorndike nonverbal things that aren't taught in school, these things predict scholastic performance on achievement tests and so on, just as well for these groups, segregated groups, as they do for groups that aren't segregated and for the white group.
Mm-hmm.
The regression lines are the same for all groups.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they do have a eugenic law there in Japan, but I don't think it has much, I think it's basically ignored. But that they're eugenics conscious. And like, for example, if somebody has if a young man has a brother who had some kind of disease or something, then no one wants to marry him. And, they're very much conscious of that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, apparently this is being pushed in Singapore. I guess you've read about the eugenic efforts there.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything lately.
I haven't heard anything lately either, so I don't know how they're working out. But it's only been in the last few years that they've been thinking along those lines, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing something about their thinking along those lines, to put it that way. I can finish off item 9 in 1 minute.
Okay.
I can simply tell you that I haven't kept up on the legal aspects of mental testing, and I don't know what's going on in that since I wrote my book on bias. I hear things now and then, but I haven't made any systematic survey of what the And that's about all I can say about that. If you ever want to talk to anyone about that sort of thing, the person who probably knows more about it than anyone I know is Barbara Lerner.
Uh-huh.
You know her?
No, I don't. Yeah. I mean, I've read her stuff, but I'm not, I don't know her personally.
Well, you know, she is a lawyer with a PhD in psychology. She did work for a time for EDS, handling all the legal problems connected with tests. And now she's working as a private consultant for people who use tests. She's like a lawyer who takes on clients, and the clients are all people with legal problems connected with tests.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. I think I'd like to, you know, talk to her about this.
Yeah, well, she lives in Princeton. I don't have her address here, but I have it down in Orinda. And she's a very, very bright woman. I've met her and had lunch with her one day at an APA convention. And she's very articulate and an excellent writer. And she's written a lot along these lines. And I think she probably has kept up on this stuff better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the person I referred to you for this question to.
Okay.
We were on item number 10. Unless there was something else you wanted to backtrack on.
No, you're right. It's number 10.
Yeah. I realized after I hung up with you last time that I said something wrong, and I can't remember just what question it was on, but I said that a 5-point difference of the mean between two groups would result in a 2-to-1 ratio difference, I think.
Uh-huh.
When you get one standard deviation above the mean.
Uh-huh.
It's actually a little less than that. It's 1.72.
Okay.
Ratio difference. 5-point difference at the mean. But, if that should come out in the thing, I can check that when,
Well, I haven't gotten to that point yet where I'm typing it.
I see when it gets to that, and when I see it, I'll recheck that. But I actually looked it up in the table. The normal distribution I was thinking was about in percentage terms, the percentage that falls above one standard deviation is about 16.
Mm-hmm.
And the percentage that falls above 1 1/3 standard deviations, which would be a group that was 5 points lower, should fall at the same point. The scale would have to be 1 1/3 standard deviations out from its mean would be about 9%.
Uh-huh.
And the difference between 9 and 16, the ratio of those two, 9 to 16 is approximately 1.7.
Right.
So, but one may not have to be that precise. I'll have to see what I actually said there when you type it up.
Okay. I can, keep an eye out for it.